From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today in Lansing, leadership asks lawmakers to clock in, get temperatures taken, and vote on the governor's emergency powers.
I'm not going to risk lives of Michiganders to participate in a partisan power struggle.
Also on the show, researchers try to work out what secrets lie in the blood of people recovered from COVID-19.
Can convalescent plasma protect people from becoming infected in the first place?
A new registry aims to match plasma donors who've had the virus with doctors who need them. And we pay tribute to a ballplayer whose gifts on the field matched his humanity on the street.
The word everyone reflexively uses when talking about Al Kaline is grace. In baseball, he was grace personified.
All that and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we're going to talk about collecting plasma from patients who have recovered from COVID-19.
So the logic is you take antibodies from someone who's recovered and give them to someone who's just starting out their course of disease.
But first, let's take a look at happenings in Lansing today. Michigan's lawmakers met to discuss further action on the coronavirus pandemic. Michigan's state response under the direction of Governor Gretchen Whitmer has won some praise, but obviously our state is also one of the most hard hit by COVID-19, with broad spread of the virus and a catastrophic number of deaths in Metro Detroit. With us now is Rick Pluta, Capitol Bureau Chief from Michigan's public radio stations. Rick, good to have you.
Hi, April.
What's happening today? What did the legislature need to meet to talk about?
Well, what the legislature is doing is meeting to adopt a resolution to extend Governor Whitmer's emergency powers to deal with the COVID-19 outbreak. And so they're coming in, they're entering the House chamber in very, very small groups, first for attendance, and then to just do a quick voice vote on the resolution itself. It doesn't have to be adopted on a record roll call like bills do. And so a lot of social distancing, it takes a lot of time to do it this way. And basically, the place is almost, but not quite empty.
Can you explain the importance of this, why it was necessary?
Well, what the governor wanted was for the legislature to simply allow her to renew the order that she's already issued. And the legislature's Republican leaders said no, that this is public business that must be dealt with by the executive and the legislative branches. And so Republican leaders, even though Democrats and the governor are saying this is not necessary, convened this extraordinary session. And I have to say, I've never seen anything like this in 30 years of covering the state capitol, but they're calling everyone in to formally adopt an extension of the governor's authority to deal with this crisis.
Now, when we say you've never seen anything like it, are you actually seeing it? Are you in Lansing right now?
I am not in Lansing. I am telecommuting. Like most of the journalists who are also covering this, it just made sense to not contribute to the public health crisis by, you know, showing up in a place where other people are. Or at least that's the decision I and most of my colleagues have made.
Right. Well, from what you can see in the live video feed, I mean, what does it look like? How different is it than usual procedure in the House and Senate chambers?
Well, sure. In the minutes leading up to a session gaveling in, whether it's in the House or the Senate, there are people milling about, that there are staffers talking to legislators, legislators going over and talking to each other. It's really, it's almost shoulder to shoulder. That is not the case today. Staff have been banned from the floor. They're not allowed to be there. Legislators expected to wait in their offices until they get the phone call that it's time for them to go over, check in again in small groups, and then wait to be called back in for a voice vote to extend the resolution. Lobbyists aren't there because there's really no one to lobby. Staffers are not allowed, and so it's just legislators providers coming in to do their business and then get out, even though the business is taking a while because it's got to be done in small groups of people.
Rick, we've heard that the Republican leadership is already looking out beyond the outbreak. We have about a minute left. What are they saying and what plans are they trying to make?
Well, what the leadership is saying is that the Senate leaders, anyway, is that even though we are in the midst of this crisis and Michigan has yet to hit its apex, according to all of the projections that that we have, that they want to start looking ahead to ramping back up businesses and public activities. And they're saying that just like there's this public health crisis, there's also an economic and mental health crisis if we don't have a plan to ramp things back up. And so they've formed this work group, not a committee. It's not subject to the public meeting rules of committees, but a work group to try and start making plans toward that end.
Do we know exactly what's on their to-do list?
On their to-do list is to talk to a lot of different groups, primarily business groups, to develop a plan to get basically the economy back up and operating once it's considered safe to do so.
Rick Pluta is Capital Bureau Chief for Michigan's public media stations. Rick, thank you so much. Stay safe.
Oh, you too, April.
Among the lawmakers who don't think the legislature should be getting together in person in Lansing is Representative Julie Brixey, Democrat from Meridian Township. She's with us now. Julie Brixey, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me on today.
Do you plan to go to the session today?
No, I don't believe that the legislature should convene unless it's necessary to protect public health. And because what they're doing is voting on an expired, rescinded emergency order, it's really pointless for us to be meeting.
Could you describe for those who've never had the pleasure in Lansing what the House floor is like? Like what your physical workspace is when you go for a vote?
It's a great big room, and there's 110 lawmakers in the House, and normally there's probably about 200 people on the floor of the House. Our desks are joined together in several different kind of columns of rows. It's really close quarters, and it's a crowded atmosphere. Now, today, they are going to be taking some special precautions to try to minimize the contact that lawmakers would have with each other. But the point is that folks are coming in from all over the state and they are going to be gathering in the Capitol and voting on a rescinded executive order.
Yeah.
So we're just gonna have to go back in a few weeks and go through this exercise again.
Well, I don't know how much of this actually came to pass, but I did see the memo that House Speaker Lee Chatfield used to lay out the protections that he did have in mind. There was a long list of people instructed to stay home, anyone with symptoms, obviously, and anyone who's had contact with people who are sick. Lawmakers were assigned time slots in which to check in, and temperatures were supposed to be taken at the door. You're saying you don't feel like this was enough preparation to keep people as safe as they could be?
It's not the safety precautions that I'm objecting to. It's a pointless exercise. I'm not going to risk lives of Michiganders to participate in a partisan power struggle. Since the 1970s, there's been over 80 instances when the governor of Michigan has issued an emergency order. In 10 of those instances, the legislature has needed to extend the order because the emergency went on for more than 4 weeks. In all 10 of those instances, the legislature simply adopted what the sitting governor had requested, the extension that the governor had requested, including in 2016, when the legislature extended Governor Snyder's emergency order for the Flint water crisis. If we were voting today on what the governor had requested, which was a 70-day extension of her emergency order and disaster order, I would certainly have been there. But I'm not going to engage in a partisan power struggle, and I'm not going to put people at risk just so that some folks can try to exercise some authority over the governor. This is a pointless exercise. You know, when they vote, there's going to be about five people in the chamber voting, and they're going to have basically a ceremonial voice vote, which illustrates that this is something that isn't needed.
Is there an argument to be made that at a time like this, Michiganders need to see the legislature and the governor speaking as one voice?
That's what I would certainly hope for. And I'm really disappointed that we weren't able to come together and do that. You know, another thing that was requested, Leader Gregg has put out a resolution asking for us to change our rules and allow...
This is the House Democratic, the Democratic Minority Leader, Christine Gregg.
Yeah. Yes, she's introducing a resolution today that would allow us to take remote votes, which would really, you know, medically be prudent in this time of crisis. Again, you know, we have to remember, what should we be doing? We should be protecting public health. We've already appropriated the funds that are necessary to continue, and we're probably going to have to appropriate additional funds before this is over. You know, so to shortchange the governor in what she's asked for, I think is playing politics, and I'm not going to engage in that.
State Representative Julie Brixey, a Democrat representing House District 69. She lives in Meridian Township. Julie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I also want to thank Michiganders everywhere for doing what they can to stay safe and support one another through this pandemic.
The sports Jones, it dies hard. Have you started doing matchups between your kids' stuffed animals yet? Maybe you're making brackets for the best isolation snacks? Coming up, Bill Shea of The Athletic talks to us about what's going on with Detroit's sports economy during physical distancing.
When there's no games, when there's no events, there's all of these other businesses that are related to them. They're not making money, and those are the people that are ultimately harmed first.
Stay with us. That's after the break. This is Stateside. I'm April Bear.
Famed number 6 Al Kaline connects for a beauty. His first World Series home run. And the Tigers are on top, 2-0.
It sends the goose pimples all over my back, and I was tremendous thrill to think that I was able to do something for the fans after all these years.
Among the many other things Detroit is mourning is the passing of Al Kaline, the Hall of Fame outfielder who played his entire 22-season career for the Tigers. He was an All-Star in 18 seasons, won 10 Golden Gloves, and was elected into the Hall of Fame his first year of eligibility in 1980. Kaline is also well-remembered for his position behind the microphone as a Tigers broadcaster for many years. With us to remember is John Neo, sports columnist for the Detroit News. John, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
There have been so many standout Tigers over the past century, but there are a few names that are really up there in the stratosphere. Ty Cobb, Willie Horton, manager Sparky Anderson. I mean, you've got to put Al Kaline among them, right?
He is. And I mean, he's Mr. Tiger is the way he's known and has been known for quite a long time. I mean, the word everyone reflexively uses when talking about Al Kaline is grace. In baseball, he was grace personified. I mean, there's countless reasons why he was so beloved in Detroit, but that's at the top of the list. The way he carried himself, he was just so genuine and sincere and self-effacing. And he came here at the age of 18. And a lot like with Gordie Howe, he was this shy, humble kid who came to Detroit, son of a broom maker, grew up poor in a row house in South Baltimore, but quickly earned everyone's respect, and then he just made sure he never lost it.
You know, not only was Al Kaline one of the guys who was voted into the Hall of Fame the first year he was eligible, he was one of the first Hall of Famers to be voted in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Why was he such a shoo-in?
Because he, you know, in a lot of ways, he was sort of the perfect ball player. He did it all. If you ask baseball people, people immediately talk about one of the best arms ever in the game of baseball in right field. I mean, Ted Williams was, you know, one of the all-time great hitters, maybe the best, would point to Al Kaline as the swing that he admired and the approach that he admired. He, at age 20, he won the American League batting title in his third year, and he was the youngest player ever to do that. And so he did it all. And again, it was the way he carried himself. You'll never find a person in the game or out of the game, really, that will have a bad word to say about Al Kaline.
And baseball's still huge in Detroit, but the game has lost some of its turf as America's pastime to other pro sports like football and basketball. Do you think that Al Kaline's time as a baseball celebrity, that kind of greatness, will ever be replicated again in the sport?
No, it's hard to say, and it is. It's a different era. I mean, he came here, and in that era, I mean, it wasn't unusual for a guy to play his entire career for one team. But for him to do it, I mean, these days it seems unbelievable that a guy would play 22 years with the same team. But the other thing that made him so special is because it wasn't just those 22 years in the Tigers uniforms. It was the nearly two decades as the broadcaster after, where, you know, a whole nother generation of fans in Detroit grew up listening to Al Kaline. And then, you know, he stuck around with the organization, became a special assistant, and has mentored just countless current Tigers, past Tigers. He was always around the ballpark. He was always around the game and approachable to the end for all of these young guys who looked up to him. They knew what he meant to the organization, but they also knew what he meant to them, you know, individually. And that was sort of his greatest trait in these last years.
You mentioned that when he was a young guy, his affect was, you know, really pretty humble.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that he maintained that demeanor too in the later years?
Oh, for sure. And everybody knew who Al Kaline was, but if you didn't, he wasn't going to tell you. And that was the thing that I think people appreciated, especially in a city like Detroit, who liked their sort of blue collar role models. And he was certainly that. But he wasn't a big fan of crowds. He wasn't even a big fan of autographs, in the sense that he just didn't want to be treated as special. He would much rather invite, you know, an almost stranger out to dinner rather than sign an autograph for him. And that's the way he was with fans, with people he'd meet, you know, around town, and with, you know, young players when they'd show up in the clubhouse for the first time in spring training. He would approach them. They wouldn't have to be scared and approach him. He was Mr. Tiger. And again, it goes back to the fact that he was just an institution with this organization and in this town.
John Neo, sports columnist for the Detroit News, joining us from his home. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, April.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In an alternate universe, we'd all be watching baseball right now. Opening day at Comerica Park passed more or less uncelebrated amid the coronavirus outbreak that's plunged the entire city of Detroit into unspeakable tragedy and loss of life. Major League Baseball postponed the start of its season following the cues of several other pro sports. Bill Shea covers the business of sports for The Athletic. He is based in Detroit. Hey, Bill, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Have you been able to tell if baseball personnel have been hit very hard by COVID-19?
Well, the major leaguers, you know, the players, the owners, the executives, for the most part, they're going to be fine. Most of them make a lot of money. When you get into the minor leagues, that's where things become a bit more problematic. A lot of your AAA players make pretty healthy wages compared to most Americans. But when you get into the lower minor leagues, that's where you run into guys making like, you know, $600-$800 a month. And when you get outside of the affiliated leagues into the independent leagues, where it's, you know, you're 18-year-olds who didn't get drafted and stuff. There's no safety net, you know, and those guys were making $600 a month, and there's no help from organized baseball in that sense. So, you know, those guys have to find jobs or do something. So, yeah, at the lower ends of pro sports and baseball in particular, there's people definitely struggling.
Right. It's pretty spooky around Detroit's downtown sports venues with everybody trying to stay home. What are some of the economic ripple effects of the shutdown of sports for Detroit?
Well, I mean, the immediate effects obviously are there's hundreds and hundreds of people involved in putting on a baseball game, aside from players and coaches and owners and things like that. You know, your ticket takers, your ushers, security guards, janitorial staff, those people, some of them will get some handouts from teams and leagues and things like that. But with Little Caesars Arena, there was hundreds of full-time people who worked putting on not just Pistons and Red Wings games, but, you know, concerts and things like that. So they're not getting their full wages. Then there's the spillover effects. Bars, restaurants, hotels that relied on games and events downtown, those aren't happening. So that money's not coming in. So not just in Detroit, but elsewhere, we're seeing huge losses of revenue for these ancillary businesses. You know, it's sort of the trickle-down. This is where trickle-down economics actually works, is when there's no games, when there's no events, there's all of these other businesses that are related to them. They're not making money, and those are the people that are ultimately harmed first.
Yeah, Bill, there's this whole cluster of development that people know as the District Detroit. How do you think that the loss of revenue for that project will affect it? It's already under a lot of scrutiny for having a bit of a lackluster ripple effect.
Yeah, I wrote, when I worked for Cranes last year, I wrote a long piece with Kirk Pinho, taking a look at sort of the promises that were made and what had actually been delivered on schedule, and it was significantly less than promised. And those sort of developments, you know, ballpark villages, as they call them, hotels, restaurants, stores, apartments, condos around stadiums, typically take about a decade to fully mature. In this case, because that stuff was already lagging, I don't know that there's a huge immediate effect. I'm sure everything is, you know, all construction is paused. And I imagine if there was any talks with, you know, tenants coming in, businesses that were thinking about signing a lease or building something in the district, probably have paused that for right now or taken a sort of a longer look. But that's one of the cases where just because it was so far beyond what had already been delivered, I don't think that's an immediate harmful effect. But if this pandemic does stretch out over a longer period of time, 6 months, a year, 18 months of this coming and going, yeah, we could see some projects like that in Detroit and elsewhere not realize their full potential.
There was a few reports surfaced over the weekend of Major League Baseball considering playing games at spring training venues down south, you know, for sort of a delayed start of the season. Boy, that sounds like a logistical nightmare. What would have to come into alignment for that to happen?
Oh, man, it would be sort of a Rube Goldberg cartoon of, you know, things that would have to happen, because it's not just baseball making decisions. You've got the players union, umpire union, you know, there's all sorts of things involved in that. And if you're going to play in these, you know, small spring training stadiums, likely without fans in attendance, I mean, you're not making much money. I'm sure they would be broadcast. I mean, on the infrastructure end, all of a sudden you have to, you know, if you're going to broadcast this on NBC or ESPN or whatever, there's a whole infrastructure there that has to be put into place. And you're trying to do this in the middle of social distancing and lockdowns and things like suppliers that supply just the daily consumables for a business. Some of them are not in operation or they're scaled way back because their supply chains are choked off.
Yeah, don't be holding your breath on those Cracker Jacks.
Toilet paper or,
right.
Or, you know, getting a haircut.
Oh, geez. Well, I mean, how long does baseball have before it has to make a decision about whether there will be a season this year?
Well, that's a good question. Baseball has played short seasons in the past. After the 94 labor stoppage, you know, they came back and played a shorter season the following year. You know, hockey has done that. I believe the NBA has done that. I would have to imagine sometime early in the summer, they're going to have to make a decision on when do we cut this off and just say, you know, we'll try again next year? But there's a lot of stakeholders involved. You know, there's the networks who are paying billions of dollars to air games. You know, it's the corporate advertisers. I mean, it's just an incredibly complex matrix of stakeholders in these things. You know, and health and safety have to be the first and foremost, because if you come back too soon and this gets really out of control, then you've opened yourself up to lawsuits.
Right. Bill, I know that you were downtown for the day when casinos in Detroit were finally allowed to start taking sports bets. That was about 2 days before sports officially ended. How do you see what's happening right now changing the financial model for Michigan's casinos?
I think as soon as this is over with, and hopefully that is sooner than later, people are going to want to consume the things that they enjoy, whether that's food and drink or if that's gambling. They will head right back to the casinos and start sticking their quarters in the slot machines or dropping a dime on, you know, the Raiders to beat the Cardinals next week, you know, whatever it might be. People will always return to their appetites and their vices and things like that.
What has it been like trying to write about sports in a world where there really aren't any sports right now, aside from esports online?
I'm very lucky in the sense that I cover the business side of it, and that is a really big story right now. I just wrote a piece on stadium construction, stadium and sports arenas. There's a bunch under construction right now across the country and elsewhere in the world. Some of those are paused. Some of them are wrapping up work so that they can pause. Some of them are still going full force. The two Major League Soccer stadiums in Ohio that are under construction, they're still going on. So I'm lucky in that sense that there is a lot to write about. I mean, there's always a lot to write about for me, but that continues. Your baseball beat writers and hockey and basketball, they've had to get creative. At The Athletic, you know, there's 400 some people on the editorial side, and they've found ways to adapt. There's a lot of Skype calls, a lot of emails, instant messages, texts back and forth. So there's still a lot to write about because this is such a unique situation, and really it's unprecedented in modern times. Twitter and TV didn't exist during the 1918-1919 flu, thank God. So you find ways to overcome and adapt. It's just like any other journalist. If you're, you know, if you're covering the auto industry or politics, this is just a new and different story to write about, and people are very interested. And there's been a lot of cool, neat stuff. You know, those are the esports that are going on. Some different, unique sports and hobbies are getting some airtime on TV, marbles and drone racing and all this sort of stuff. And people are looking to watch stuff, but they're interested in stuff that, like, our writers are, you know, doing some Q&As. And we just had a story on, hey, you know, what are the organists from, like, the hockey and baseball stadiums doing right now? Just an endless number of stories to be told, even when the games are not being played. But hopefully before long, the games are being played.
You know, we're not asking you to speak for the place you work for, but, you know, The Athletic had really been getting a foothold in the landscape of sports journalism. Does it feel like a setback for what you guys have been trying to build?
I was obviously initially very concerned about this, but the more I thought about it, and, you know, our bosses have been very open and transparent. You know, we operate basically on Slack because there's no newsroom for us. We're all over the country. So it's been very, very positive. And, you know, because there's a lot to write about that, you know, after the initial concern of, like, oh my God, all of the sports leagues have stopped. What do we do? Well, you overcome and you adapt, and people are still subscribing. You know, it's certainly not the same traffic as, you know, on the Super Bowl or something like that. But because we have such great writers and journalists and such interesting and compelling and provocative content still coming out, that people are still saying, oh yeah, I will sign up for that. And they're doing a 90-day free trial, you know. So on the business side, you know, The Athletic and other journalism sites and operations are figuring out the business side of trying to maintain things. But yeah, I mean, we were, you know, we're only 3 years old and it's still on an upward trend, and we have about a million paid subscribers now. It's still healthy. I mean, obviously it would be a lot healthier if all of the leagues were still playing right now.
It feels like a lot of the pain has been concentrated in local news organizations and their coverage of sports so far.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, because a lot of newspaper companies were in precarious situations, and you see like Gannett responding with, you know, employees have to take an unpaid week off every week for the next 3 months. You know, and when I was at Cranes for 13 years, I wrote a lot about the local media situation. And that's, you know, that's not just a local, it's a national story as well, because they're owned by large corporations elsewhere. So all of the troubles with like the newspaper industry, these enormous conglomerates that took out staggering amounts of debts, and then you get the private equity folks coming in, you know, an industry that was hanging by a thread already, that thread in some places has frayed even more. And I'm not sure that there's been ever a more important time to have top-notch journalism unfolding for the benefit of everyone in the country and the world. So to see layoffs and things like that at news organizations, I mean, it's heartbreaking anyways, but at a time like this, when the public needs to know and the public isn't always getting the most truthful or full answers out of the government, makes it even a bigger crisis.
Bill Shea covers sports business issues for The Athletic. We talked to him over Skype from his home in Detroit. Bill, you stay safe.
Thanks, you too.
Did you know that plasma donated by people who've had COVID-19 might help other people build up resistance?
Is it effective? We don't know. We will know once the trials are done. A major issue, by the way, that's clearly in front of us is if this is to be used, we're going to need a lot of donors, because very quickly, you know, the supply will run out.
Scientists in East Lansing are working to set up a way to make it easier for recovered folks to donate plasma and for doctors to find them. We'll talk about how it works after the break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As the state's COVID-19 caseload is now well into the five-digit range, a growing number of Michiganders have recovered from the virus, and it turns out they have an increasingly important role to play. Joining us now is Dr. Nigel Paneth. He's an epidemiologist at Michigan State University, and he's on the leadership team with what's known as the National Convalescent Plasma Project. Dr. Paneth, welcome to Stateside.
Good to be on, April.
Your project has developed an online clearinghouse for sharing information about plasma as a treatment for people who may be at risk of being infected with the new coronavirus or who may have already become infected. Can you tell us about what is special about plasma from a person who has already recovered?
Well, there's a long history in medicine of using convalescent plasma, which is presumably rich in antibodies to the disease that one is concerned with, and giving it to people with the disease in an attempt to provide them at least temporary immunity or to bolster their response to the virus or the agent of disease. This goes back 100 years. It was used before we had antibiotics. It was used widely in pneumococcal pneumonia. It's been used for many viral diseases. Attempts, brief or short, small samples, papers have been published on its use in SARS and MERS, the two other coronavirus disease, in H1N1 flu in Hong Kong. And they seem encouraging, and we don't know for certain, of course, that convalescent plasma will be useful, but we're undertaking the trials, and people are already starting to use it in places like New York.
Do we know why convalescent plasma can have an effect to boost people's immune systems?
Well, you have formed antibodies. Remember, if you've been infected with many, if not most, viral illnesses, should you be challenged again with that virus, you will not come down with it. You know, smallpox, for example, you used to get permanent immunity from having a case. Polio, many other, especially viral infections, more so than bacterial infections, give you a fairly robust permanent immunity. Nobody gets measles twice, you know. So why is that? Well, because you formed antibodies in the course of the illness that fight the virus. So the logic is you take antibodies from someone who's recovered and give them to someone who's just starting out their course of disease. And the hope is that that infusion of antibodies will help the immune system, which is just gearing up to fight the virus, and someone who's not doing quite as well with it as the person who recovered.
What's the difference between this kind of plasma treatment and an actual vaccine?
Well, the vaccine is what we call active immunity, and this is passive immunity. Active means we stimulate your system to produce antibodies, your own system to produce antibodies to the virus. That's the ultimate game changer when we have a vaccine. This is passive immunity. You're given antibodies. You didn't produce them yourself. They're just from somebody else. And they probably will stick around for a brief period of time. Nobody knows quite how long, maybe a couple of months, but we don't think it gives you permanent immunity because you're not manufacturing them yourself. You're getting them from somebody else. If you recover, if they're effective and there was a vaccine developed, you would still be eligible for a vaccine.
Right. Why is it important to have a website for information about who's doing plasma trials and who might be in a position to donate?
Well, we just thought that it would be essential to try to get the word out. The group of us that began to work together nationally on this project felt that we needed to have a place to go to learn about the process as much as we can, learn about the regulatory barriers that exist, learn about the opportunity to give donations, learn about how we can maybe monitor its treatment, all sorts of things like that. The website is still gathering information as we go. It's largely served so far as a clearinghouse to link donors to recipients or potential recipients. We also are trying to get a functionality going which has to do with making at least some brief and simple observations on the outcome of people treated with convalescent plasma. Of course, you know, we really need trials. We hope our website will help link people who want to participate in trials as well. I don't mean so much patients as groups of physicians or hospitals or clinics that say, we would like to join, we will enroll our patients in a trial. So hopefully all of these functionalities can be helpful. There's another site just been set up at Mayo Clinic with the help of the FDA under the auspices of the Expanded Access Program, which allows people to use convalescent plasma in either very sick patients or in patients who might become very sick. It seems to be, I'm not sure it's an absolute requirement or a recommendation, that they enroll the recipients in this website at Mayo Clinic. They've organized it. They've got past the IRB on this. And that's another important website, which we link to in our website.
The FDA greenlit testing to find out if convalescent plasma treatments can show clinical results in a way that might help sooner rather than later. Can you tell us anything about who's doing the testing?
Yes. There have been, to my knowledge, at least three, there may be more, applications to do trials. And that is separate from the Expanded Access Program. The Expanded Access Program covers just you're just treating outside of a trial. Trials have another pathway through the FDA. You see, the reason you're going through the FDA is because this is a new biological product. So it requires an investigational new drug approval, either for trials or even for clinical use. So the first step that the FDA did was authorize emergency use, and that was a one-by-one person. That was issued on March the 24th or 25th. Then on, I think it's April 2nd, they put out this expanded access which covered a larger group of people and didn't require a one-by-one application, although that one-by-one application is still available to clinicians should they wish to use it, and then simultaneously create a website, sort of a registry to place people in collaboration with the Mayo Clinic who are part of our leadership team, so we're all working together on this.
Right. Just to be clear, if I didn't make it clear, though, that's a separate effort than what your project is helping to facilitate.
Yeah, it's separate, but we are talking to each other so we don't interfere or overlap unnecessarily.
Right.
So the trials now, one has been approved, just one, to Johns Hopkins. And at Johns Hopkins, this trial is to study the use of convalescent plasma in people who are exposed or at high risk of getting infected but are not yet infected. So very early, can convalescent plasma protect people from becoming infected in the first place?
So people like first responders, perhaps.
There you go. People working in hospitals. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you give them something that's a kind of an armor, in addition to their PPE, additional layer of armor, to protect them for at least a month or two against the effects of this virus? So I'm very happy to see that trial going forward. You can talk to the people at Hopkins. The principal investigator there, he's on our leadership team, is Shmuel Shoham. And we're beginning to try to work with him through our website and other means to try to connect him to pools of people who might be ideal candidates to participate in such a trial.
If plasma transfusions can be proved to boost immunity, is it ultimately something that might lead to treatments that everyone could get?
Well, if the trials are effective, particularly in the people at risk, then you could make a case for, you know, at least until a vaccine comes around, possibly some widespread use of plasma around the country. I don't think it would be feasible to give it to that many people. How many donors do you have after all? But maybe in certain high-risk situations especially. Then, of course, we have to learn, and trials hopefully will get going soon, as to whether it works in early stages of people who are sick, who are infected and sick, or maybe in the hospital, or, you know, even maybe more advanced cases. We'll have to do trials in all those settings to find out where is the best place to use convalescent plasma, if at all, because we just don't know whether it works. We're strong believers, all of us, and you have to do a trial first before you announce a medication or a drug or a transfusion works.
One of the pressing problems of the moment is that there are a lot of people out there who are sick, but who can't get tested.
Yep.
They may be sick with symptoms that look like COVID-19. They may recover. Does a person have to have had a positive test for COVID-19 to be eligible to donate plasma?
We don't think so. Now, I'll tell you what the situation is. The Red Cross has said, if you think you had COVID-19 but didn't have a test for it, and you have fulfilled the at least minimum requirements for donating, which is 14 days free of symptoms, right? At least 14 days. If you had a positive test during the course of the illness, the Red Cross at least, and not every blood bank operates precisely the same way, but I do know how Red Cross does this, they will require you to have had a negative test before you walk into the blood bank. They don't want people coming into blood banks who are still carrying virus.
Right.
Okay? So that's understandable. What if you've never had a test? Well, what the Red Cross has told me they would probably do is try to measure antibody in advance and see if you have an antibody response. So if you think you've had COVID-19, Red Cross will try to arrange testing for antibody status in advance and see if you have antibody and use that as a guide to whether you should give the plasma. For people who have been infected, clearly no doubt about it, and now it's cleared, they're going to, I think, take the plasma and test it once they've taken it because the probability of that plasma being antibody-rich is very high. But for people who never tested, they may wish to test antibody status in advance.
What should people do if they want to donate plasma right now?
Well, they should go to one of the donor sites, our own, ccp19.org, or the Red Cross donor site, all of which we list every other donor site we know about. We also give connections to local areas that are just collecting by themselves, a group in North Carolina, a group in St. Louis, clinicians who are working together. So perhaps if you live in that neighborhood, you know, you might say, oh, I'm in St. Louis, why not go straight to the St. Louis folks? They may tell you to go to your local Red Cross, or they may say, come to our hospital, we're taking care of it now. You know, so we're trying to give every possible donor option to people. But we're certainly still getting a lot of people, even though we've posted these on our own website. Please put yourself down. Now, we don't know when we get a donor, we don't know that they're qualified. We don't know. Let's be frank. Some people say, I think I had a bad infection in November. I think it was COVID-19. Well, if it was in November, it was probably flu, not COVID-19. So there's going to be a sorting out process. That's understandable. We don't want to do anything to get in the way of people's urge and energy to try to help. And so we give people guidance, but we don't know how effective a donor people will be when they register. But then they can go to a place that takes donations of plasma, and that can be sorted out then.
What kind of timeline do you think is realistic to expect for clinical results on how effective convalescent plasma treatments might be?
I think it's very important not to get too far ahead of what we know. This is a promising treatment. It makes sense. Is it effective? We don't know. We will know once the trials are done. A major issue, by the way, that's clearly in front of us is if this is to be used, we're going to need a lot of donors because very quickly, you know, the supply will run out. So I would urge everybody who thinks they can be a donor to sign up to be a donor. We keep everybody's information. We will try to link every single person to a potential place as soon as we know of it, a place for them to go to. And the default, I think, would be if you don't know your local Red Cross blood bank, if you don't know anywhere to go, at least start from there. But hopefully within the next, you know, few weeks, we will learn, you know, trials can be mounted very quickly. And we will find out quickly enough whether this works, at least in the first settings it's being tried in. Hopefully some good will come of this.
Dr. Nigel Paneth, an epidemiologist affiliated with Michigan State University, has been working on establishing the National Convalescent Plasma Project with a group of colleagues. Dr. Paneth, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, April. All the best.
People have been flooding into Leelanau County since COVID-19 hit Michigan last month, and local health officials are worried about it. They're asking visitors to self-quarantine. Interlochen Public Radio's Noelle Riley caught up with some essential workers in the county to see how they're feeling about the increased traffic.
It's a sunny spring day. Grocer Sarah Alice is filling curbside pickup orders at the Leland Mercantile. She says the store is busier than usual for this time of year.
I'm just a little concerned about people coming from really populated areas. A lot of summer people that usually wouldn't come up till after Easter or, you know, May, and they're coming early to open their summer houses.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer has asked Michigan residents to stay home. But her executive order doesn't specifically say people can't go to their second homes up north. So local health departments have asked anyone traveling to the region to self-quarantine for 14 days. Alice hopes people follow those recommendations.
We're just doing the best we can, and we're not turning people away, you know. I mean, it's good for our business. We're doing a lot of curbside pickups.
Many grocers prefer curbside pickup over people coming into their stores right now. That includes Connie Frost, owner of Hansen Foods in Suttons Bay. And she says visitors aren't trying to hide when they come up north.
Most of them are very verbal about letting us know that they feel it's safer here, just by the numbers.
They may feel safer, but they bring an increased risk for year-round residents. Michelle Klein is the director of personal health at the Benzie-Leelanau District Health Department. She worries the positive cases of coronavirus could spike if people aren't more cautious.
As more and more people are coming up to this area, our healthcare system doesn't have the capability to manage, you know, large numbers of people. And so there is a fear that if too many people come up to the area, especially if they come up and then develop symptoms and then become ill, that our healthcare system up here may become overwhelmed.
IPR reached out to one downstate health department, Washtenaw County, to see whether they're telling residents not to travel up north. It's the sixth most populated county in the state, home to the city of Ann Arbor. An official there said they've been asked a lot of questions about COVID-19, but nobody's called to ask whether they should go to their cottage. So the Washtenaw County Health Department hasn't given any specific guidance on it. Over in Northport, Rebecca Roman remains worried. She works at Deep's Corner Store and says their community is fragile.
We're so small that one person gets sick in this area that almost the whole town's going to get sick then.
I'm Noelle Riley.
That feature was produced for Interlochen Public Radio. You may have seen videos emerge last week of shaggy mountain goats roaming the empty streets of a village in Wales. Residents captured the goats all over the place.
There are goats everywhere.
Standing on top of stone walls, eating people's hedges. Running down the street together day and night. Goat hooligans. Well, the Welsh mountain goats aren't the only wildlife taking advantage of people being indoors and all those empty roadways. There are videos of wild peacocks in Mumbai, deer in London, pumas in Santiago, all seeming a little out of place in urban settings. We've also seen reports closer to home, mountain lions in California suburbs, a coyote in downtown Chicago. Closer still, wild turkeys in Ypsilanti. If you've noticed increased wildlife traffic in your neck of the woods, maybe caught some turkeys or deer on video or a picture, we'd love to see what you're seeing out your window. Send your wildlife pics and videos to stateside@michiganradio.org. And tomorrow on the show, we'll be speaking with the head of the Detroit Zoo about the phenomenon of wildlife in urban spaces.
Well, I think it's kind of obvious that they were here first. So, you know, this really was their environment before we arrived. And I think it's wonderful. I think it's, you know, for all of us, really, we've just got to pay a lot more attention to the impact that we have and make sure that what we're doing is a positive, not a negative. It would be wonderful to have wildlife around on a regular basis, not simply when places are deserted.
That's tomorrow on Stateside. That's our show for today. Today's edition of Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our interim executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Producers are Mike Blank and April Van Buren, with help from our interns Leah Baldori, Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. You stay safe. We'll catch up with you tomorrow.